Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a British slapstick comedy that makes you laugh and think about surviving the chaos of life. Then, Secrets and Lies in Literature by Women and Non-Binary Writers. Also, a Berkeley artist reflects on her artwork and life lessons she learned from having cancer. And I have a big pre-Halloween event tomorrow night, and you're invited. Today's show is about deeper meanings. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Before we get into the next interview, have you RSVP'd for my event? I'm excited because tomorrow night I'm hosting a fun, frightful storytelling event, and it's called Creepy Tales. I know this music isn't creepy, but it's a creepy event. And it's happening Thursday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. at KLW's downtown San Francisco venue. And we have a stellar lineup of artists and storytellers. So stick around to the end of the show to hear more. And you can go to klw.org/events for more information. Okay, so noises off. This music goes great with noises off. It's a play within a play. The hilarious slapstick British comedy is about a theater cast and crew rehearsing for their show's opening night. But everything that you think could go wrong does, like wrong to the 10th power wrong. There's just so much drama backstage. The castmates are sleeping around with each other. The tensions are rising and people are struggling with their lines. Noises Off is by English playwright Michael Frayn, and it debuted over 40 years ago, but it's still cracking audiences up. And it's running now at the San Francisco Playhouse. Actor Joe Ayers plays the arrogant but clumsy leading actor Gary Lejeune. I spoke with Joe Ayers about the deeper meaning of the play and the physical demand of this production. Joe Ayers, I am so happy to talk to you.
Hello, hello.
This play, Noises Off, is a hot mess. And I don't use that phrase a lot, but this play, the characters are a hot mess. But before we even dig into Noises Off, I just want to talk a little bit about your background. So you live in LA now. You recently moved there.
Yes.
Yes. But you are a Cal Bear.
I'm a Cal. Go Bears.
Go Bears. You've taught at Chabot College too, as well.
Yes, Go Gladiators.
So, Go Gladiators. So you definitely, which is where Tom Hanks went, right?
Sure did.
That's right. Okay, so you taught in the theater department there. How did living here in the Bay Area shape your acting career?
I love that question. It quite literally is the reason I'm an actor. When I moved here at 18, I knew in my heart I wanted to be an actor, but I don't think I had the confidence at the time to really make it a reality. And I actually decided at Cal in my first acting class with the legendary Margot Hall. I will sing her praises every chance I get. But we spent a whole class period my freshman year talking about what it means to be an actor in the Bay specifically. And she was just talking about her life. She teaches all the shows she does. And we spent the whole time, like whole 2 hours, just like getting to talk to her, ask her questions. And I walked out that day and I was like, that's what I want to do. This is where I got my start. My first professional shows after I graduated were in the Bay. I worked for 2 years before I went to grad school, and I was just teaching, acting, directing, like I was doing it all. And I think San Francisco, I love the theater community here, and I'll always come back to it because it is very welcoming.
You teach too.
Yes.
What do you tell your students? Like, what's some advice that you give them?
With my students, I mean, I remind them that they're brilliant. Like, that's first and foremost. I approach them as if they're innately brilliant because I think they are. You know, and I remind them that, like, you show up to class because you believe in yourself. But being an actor, I tell them, like, you know, the number one thing you have to have is faith. You have to believe that you can do this because this industry can be very unforgiving. It can be really brutal. And, you know, and I do tell them too, I'm very real. Like, if you feel like you can go do something else that is like more suited to, you know, what you want out of your life, go do that. There's no shame in that. It's not like giving up. You know, I tell them dreams change. The training that they get in my classes, I'd say acting training is human training. So any field, these are transferable skills. So I really believe in the power of theater education for that reason, you know, and I tell them any career you go into, you're going to need these skills, you know, so I'm like, and that makes them take the training really seriously. It's not, you know, I'm not necessarily training them to be professional actors. I'm training them to be good people.
No, definitely. You know, classes you take in the arts, they definitely help you off stage too. I totally agree with that. And speaking of off, noise is off. Noise is off.
Here we go.
Look, I can't even describe it. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. And it's a play within a play. Right. Okay, so the play I'm watching is called Noises Off. The play that they're struggling to put on, and they are struggling to put this play on, is Noises On. No, Nothing On.
Right.
Which I like that it's called Nothing On, because it feels like the play that's in the play is about nothing.
Correct.
It's I was like, this is about nothing. I'm right, right?
I mean, the thing is that, and we talk about this as a cast, we're like, what is going on in Nothing On? Like, we're like, what is the actual plot? You know, I mean, and it is. So it's a sex farce, right? That it's these couples coming thinking they're going to, you know, get to be with each other, and they don't understand that, like, you know, oh, there's all these people in the house, you know, and that's where the chaos ensues, which is so funny. But yeah, I'm like, it's kind of hilarious that you never find out the actual end of Nothing On, because it's technically like the first act. So we're like, you're seeing the first act three times. We're like, is it a one act? We don't know. Is there more?
Right. And then, oh my God, one of the funniest scenes is when they're telling the audience, you know, that the show's going to start. Right. And like, it takes them 10 minutes and they keep coming in. A different actor's like, the show is starting 2 minutes.
Correct.
The show is starting 3 minutes. The show is starting 1 minute. I know people listening are like, what is this about? Just trust me. It's funny. It feels like you may think it's about nothing, but when you watch it, it is about something.
Correct.
It's definitely about something. Well, definitely the play itself is about these characters. They can't get it together because it's so much. They sleeping around with each other. There's some tensions it's messy. There's tensions between the castmates, and it just explodes. It's kind of like real life. That's
exactly
how I felt watching. I was like, it's messy.
Correct.
Like, life can be messy. And when you just holding in resentments and stuff and the pressures, and then this is a boiling pot of madness and foolishness.
Right. And I think, you know, something we talked about with it is, what is the point of Noises Off as a play, right? Like, what should the audience kind of take away? What's the message? And I think on what we landed on as a cast and with our director is, like, you know, this is life. It's messy. And, you know, it's like the ultimate example of the show must go on, taken to the very extreme, you know, but it's like, that's the thing. And that's life. Life goes on. It's messy. You're gonna make mistakes. There's gonna be resentment. There's gonna be jealousy. There's gonna be volatile emotion, like, throughout, and you keep going, right? And that's kind of like, by the end in our production, like, the way that we've staged it, it does actually get me very emotional that it's like, things have gone completely to hell. But the thing that we do, you know, and it's like, and people sometimes are very, like, you know, confused by the end of the show, because it is just chaos. You know what I mean? Like, toward the end, but we kind of have made it into this like ritual that it's like, no, we're going to do this. We're going to make it up as we go. And we're going to get to the end.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Joe Ayers. He stars in the wild stage comedy Noises Off, and it's running at the San Francisco Playhouse until November 8th. If you need a laugh and you like British comedy, I definitely recommend it. Definitely has elements of British comedy, you know, the sexiness to it, just the type of humor. But there's a ton of slapstick. It's a slapstick comedy. And Joe, you do a lot of it. And again, I tip my hat off to you, because
all of them
do slapstick. You do it at another level too as well. But how do you train for something like that? Because you're falling and you're rolling around. I wanted to take some Motrin out of my purse and give it to you when I was watching you on stage.
Thank you. I'll take it. No, I mean, I've been an athlete my whole life. I played soccer growing up, and one of my degrees in college was dance. So I kind of kept my body, you know, in shape in that way. And in graduate school, I did a lot of clowning, physical theater, and I like to stay as active as I can, you know, the older I get. Mm-hmm. And with a show like this, it actually it's the hardest show I've ever done, for sure. Purely based off physicality alone, because, you know, we're running up and down stairs. It's like a 2-hour, 40-minute show. Like, it's kind of like go, go, go once you get into it. And, you know, while we were in rehearsals, we were rehearsing 8 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
And, you know, it was hard on my body. I was like, oh my gosh, am I able to pull this off, you know? But it kind of demanded that I take care of my body in a way that I haven't, you know, or I've been like letting slide by. I'm like, ah, you're fine. Just do a little stretch, you know? And now,
oh no,
right. You know, just a little, I'm like, that is not going to cut it. So you know, every night I come home, I roll out on like a foam roller, you know, I'm drinking my water. I'm making sure I sleep enough, like things that I kind of would take for granted. And I'm like, I never will again. and you know, we had an amazing fight stunt and intimacy coordinator named Chelsea Pace, who choreographs all of the slapstick, all the falls, anything that we do physically. And she is like an utmost professional, like just so good.
Shout out to Chelsea.
Shout out to Chelsea. I'm impressed. Yes, she is so incredible and just made it so easy. You know, I was scared with some of the stuff. I was like, am I going to be able, how am I going to fall down these stairs? Yeah. And
but you took on that challenge when you saw the script.
Sure did. You know, I was like, all right. And then I found out it was Chelsea who's doing it. I was like, okay, I've worked with her on the play That Goes Wrong, which I did at San Francisco Playhouse last fall. And that actually, so Noises Off inspired the play That Goes Wrong. Fun fact. Yes. So if you see both, you'll definitely see the nods. But so I'd worked with Chelsea before and I really trusted her. And, you know, when she found out that I was playing Gary, she was like, okay, thank God. Because, you know, I'm sure for her, it's also like, how am I going to throw this person? She wanted to make sure it was someone who could do it.
And you're doing like more than one show a day. So
sometimes, yeah. 2 days of the week, we do two show days. So, you know, it's like, it's all very safe and I feel very good doing it. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, I'm like, I got to do what I need to do for my body.
And I didn't ask you, describe Gary, the character that you play.
Oh, Gary. Gary Lejeune, as I like to call him. I'm not sure if that's actually his name, but I imagine he would do the French pronunciation.
Of course he would.
Gary is one of the, you know, quote unquote, more experienced actors in the troupe. And he is having a relationship with Dottie, who is kind of the lead actress in this production. She's, you know,
and Dottie is an older
Dottie
woman.
Is shout an out to Dottie. Older woman, yes.
Dottie. I had to say that much. I don't want to give it away.
Played by the fabulous Julie Eccles. She's a wonderful thing partner. The way I describe him is he is someone who really focused on his acting training and forgot how to be a person, you know, or like didn't grow as much as a person as he did as an actor. So, you know, he's kind of in his own world in terms of his view of the world. He thinks he knows what's up. He knows there's nothing left for him to learn. And the course of the show, he does. You know, he's like a little, I would say, emotionally stunted. I think he does love his castmates to a degree. And they, you know,
it does give dysfunctional family.
Right.
Yeah.
You know.
It's kind of like a dysfunctional family. And there's a scene in the second act, fabulous scene, where the entire cast does slapstick. That's when the poop has hit the fan. And so they're all doing slapstick. They're not saying anything, but they are all in sync. And they are, I mean, it's all type of props that they're using where you guys could really hurt yourself. So I was just really impressed with that scene and what you all did and how you were in sync.
Thank you.
Like you all were in sync. Like somebody would drop something and catch it or block themselves and they're not even looking. How long did it take to even do that, to practice that scene?
Act two, we spent probably the most time on because we had to, right? It's very physical. It's so much mime and clown and physical storytelling. You know, when we do talkbacks and things, people always want to ask about act two. And I think it's a perfect example of an ensemble truly working together. And if everyone's doing their bit, it all comes together beautifully and it just works.
Like life.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Joe, because you definitely put a smile on our faces.
That's our job. That's what we aim for.
That was actor Joe Ayers. See him in the comedy Noises Off, and it's running at the San Francisco Playhouse until November 8th. Coming up, why a group of women and non-gender binary writers are going to expose secrets and lies in their Lit Quick event. Woo! Don't turn that dial or click away. They're going to spill some tea. We'll be back. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. All month long, the literary festival Litquake has been leaving San Francisco audiences with lots of good storytelling and insightful discussions. Writers Samantha Shea and Sarah Rose Cotterett will be reading tomorrow night for their event, Generation Women, Secrets and Lies. The female and non-binary writers range in age from 20 to 70 and up. Now, unfortunately, their show is sold out. I mean, that's good news, but for us, that's not. But there are other Litquake events shaking up, like this Saturday's Lit Crawl in the Mission. So in the meantime, Samantha and Sarah are going to spill some tea today and talk about secrets and lies in literature. And they're here with me now. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you.
And Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. So Samantha, I'll start with you. You're an accomplished writer. You're on the staff of the New York Times Wirecutter, which reviews products. You founded Independent Bookstore Day in 2014. Yay! And your debut book is titled My Mother's Boyfriend. So, okay. You know we're going to talk about that a little later. But I want to first ask you about Generation Women. So tell us about Generation Women.
So, pre-COVID, I was in New York, and my friend took me to a show called Generation Women that she had been to before, and it completely blew my mind. And it was exactly the format we do today, which it was six storytellers, each representing a decade of life, so team 20s, team 30s, nice. Et cetera, up to 70s, and in some cases up to the 90s, telling a personal story on a theme. And not only was it so entertaining and like educational and moving, but I also felt like, oh, this is the kind of diversity we don't see that often or even talk about, this intergenerational diversity and how important it is to hear, for us all to hear voices from different generations and ages. And I wanted to bring it here. Didn't work out. Finally, I did it with Litquake post-COVID, and we've been doing it now for 3 years, I guess.
And so why the theme Secrets and Lies? I mean, that's juicy, but...
Still. I mean, basically because it's juicy, yeah. Because Secrets and Lies brings out good stories, I guess, is really the reason.
Yeah, especially so I'm thinking with women and non-gender, you know, binary literature too as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some really, really good stuff, some deep stuff. So Sarah, you are also an accomplished writer and you're an alum of the Breadloaf Writers Conference, which is super competitive, super, super competitive. What does the theme of Secret and Lies mean to you? And what does that bring up for you?
Ooh, where to begin? Yeah, I think as Samantha said, it is really juicy, especially when you're talking about literature, because so much of writing is about trying to delve into something and uncover connections or meanings that make meanings out of events that we would typically think of as having like some greater significance. So Secrets and Lies, I mean, you're going to hear a little bit about one that happened to me, a secret in my life.
Oh, okay. Well, and later on in this interview, you're going to read, both of you are going to give us a little sample, a little taste.
Yeah.
Of what to expect. So, and I'm definitely looking forward to that. What brought you both to writing?
I wanted to be a writer literally for as long as I can remember.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, I did have sort of an aha moment when I took my first creative writing class as an undergraduate, where I thought, oh, I could do this. Like, I could just choose to do this. I think before that, I felt like someone had to anoint you, kind of like, you know, it was like, it seemed about as realistic as becoming a fairy princess or something to say I was going to be a writer there. What? It just didn't seem like something you could choose to do. And so, so that was my sort of aha moment that you can, no matter, you know, what family you came from or what background you came from, you can be a writer. Like all you have to do is write and say you're a writer.
Yeah. What about you, Sarah?
Absolutely. I think I have a similar, as long as I can remember, I've wanted to be a writer. That was the first thing that I remember, really thinking that I wanted to do. And I've just been doing it as long as I've been literate, I think. and I think, for me, literature was a way of getting outside of myself and learning about other experiences, like trying to realize what it would be like to live as someone else. And that was just an incredible feeling. It's like an epiphany, you know, like something that you can't really come back from. And I didn't want to, so...
Oh, and you didn't want to. Yeah, I was the same way. I knew when I was little, I wanted to be a writer, and like pens and pencils always excited me. And like I said, when I was little, a good weekend was going to Walden Books and then getting some stationery at like thrifties or something. Yeah. Like
The writing accoutrements were so exciting. Paper, pencils, pens, all that stuff.
Yeah. So then when Office Depot came, or those, and I was like, whoa, when I was younger. I was like, oh. And I still to this day, I'll go on and I don't even need it. I'll just like wander around the stationery store just because I like that so much. But let's hear a little bit, you know, of some of your work. I'm disappointed. Well, I have an event tomorrow night, but I see why you all are sold out. You must be excited.
I'm really excited. That you're sold out. And I'm thrilled we're sold out. I'm sort of bummed because I have friends and that can't come.
Yeah.
But really, I'm thrilled.
I mean, because people like that kind of stuff. And I'm just, people don't know what to expect either.
Gossip.
Oh, of course. Or just like, you know, everybody is funny. I met someone who, how do I describe them? They were a federal agent. I'll just say that. Uh-huh. And I went to an event that they were having, and I was shocked that they were an agent, because their appearance, you would never think they're an agent. And they had wrote a book, and I was telling that person, I said, you know, I told her, I was like, in journalism, they say everyone has a story. And then she said, where she works, they say everybody has a secret. And then I was like, what you know about me? Because she I was like, how much secret?
Where's the file?
Right? Where's the file on me, right? But yeah, I just thought that was interesting when she said that. So that always sticks with me. But who wants to go first?
You went. I'll go first. Okay.
Okay. So Samantha. Okay. Yeah. So Samantha. Okay. So tell us. So each about 2 minutes. So tell us.
Okay.
Tell us, is this from your book?
This is not from my book. This is nonfiction. My book is fiction. So
okay. Oh, that's right.
This is just from my life.
Okay.
And I wrote it for this event. So.
Okay. Okay. So this is a sneak peek.
Sneak peek. Right. In my life, I've had 2 step siblings, 1 half brother, a fake half sister, 4 stepmothers, 1 stepfather, plus various and sundry parental lovers, live-ins, girlfriends, boyfriends, and roommates. By the time I left for college, I'd lived in 8 different houses with my mom and spent weekends and vacations at least another 8 with my dad. I had 2 step-grandmas, 2 real grandmas, and a long-lost maternal grandfather I didn't know about until I was 17. None of this was strange to me as a kid, and I was deep into adulthood before I understood how unusual it was. I'm a 3rd-generation California bohemian. I was born in 1970. These things happened. But one of these things was not like the others. I was 12 when my nuclear family dreams came true. My father and his 3rd wife, Donna, had a daughter and gave me the baby sister I had always longed for. I already had a little half-brother from my father's 2nd wife, but he was a boy and, despite being super cute, still a boy. But baby Jenny, pale as an egg with a lumpy bald head, was all girl, and she was all mine. When we met for the first time, she was 7 months old, and she grabbed my face and started sucking on my cheek with painful vigor. I was in love. At the time, my father, stepmother, and little brother were living at Karma Choling, a beautiful Buddhist meditation center in rural Vermont that smelled of miso soup and incense. Some people might call it a cult, and they would be a little bit right. We bowed and chanted and all wore the same styles and liked the same things and said the same things, but we were allowed to leave anytime we wanted. It was cult light.
Mm.
I'll just leave it there. Cult I didn't even light. Get to the secret yet.
Cult light.
Cult light.
Ooh, okay. All right, so for those that were able to get a ticket tomorrow night, that just gives you an idea of what your story is going to be about. So now we need to find somebody who went to your event so we can hear the and I don't want to ask too many questions because I was like, I know.
Well, LitQuick does record these and put them up.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think you can watch them or listen to them on, I don't know, through their website.
Okay, so hopefully, they record. I wasn't sure if they record all of them.
I know they're recording ours. So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. Okay, Sarah.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm reading the first part of what I'll be reading tomorrow night. So it also ends on a cliffhanger.
Of course. Please.
All right. I'm going to spin you a tale of 2 secrets. the first secret was my boyfriend's. We were together for 5 years, lived together for 3.5, and adopted a perfect angel dog together. We had been planning a big vacation to Japan where, unbeknownst to either of us, we were both planning to propose. When I walked into the kitchen in the middle of the workday, his head was buried between two computer screens. I peered over his shoulder. On one screen, he was using ChatGPT to put together an itinerary for Tokyo. On the other, he was sexting. "Who is that?" I said.
Uh-oh.
He quickly shut the laptop. "No one." "What do you mean, no one?" The problem with cheating on a nonfiction writer is that we do research for fun. So over the next few months, I tracked down not only the person he had been sexting, but about 20 other people that he had cheated with in some way. He cheated with people locally, people in LA where he lived part-time for work, people in other states when he traveled, and people who existed entirely in his phone. He was sexting people almost nonstop. I had inklings, of course. For example, it was strange how whenever he said he was picking up burritos on his way home from work, somehow the order always got screwed up and he came home about an hour later than expected. But it would be ridiculous for me to assume that between Papalote and the Bay Bridge, he was stopping at a woman's house to quickly have sex before coming home to me with dinner, right? That would be impossible. Something you should know about digital natives is that we keep receipts. These women sent me screenshots of his texts with timestamps. They sent me his dating profile. They told me the names of other women that he had mentioned, and so I contacted them too. But the most profound revelation was that all of us blamed him. And that's where I'll stop.
And now he on the radio. We didn't put him on blast on the radio.
And his full name and address
oh
is...
Oh, my God, no! Don't dox him, please. We're lying. See, I talked to you the other day. We texted about
nope,
this.
Nope, nope. I'm not giving you anything
about,
else.
We texted about it. You behaving.
I'm behaving.
Because Sarah's like, can I say this and that? When I read the story, when they texted me yesterday, I was like, wait a minute.
That was the clean version.
That's the clean. Mm-hmm. Ooh, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with writers Samantha Shea and Sarah Rose Cotterett. They're part of the sold out Litquake event called Generation Women, Secrets and Lies. You just heard a little bit of it. But Litquake has other events, including this Saturday's Lit Crawl. And throughout the evening on Lit Crawl, you can stop by various pubs and venues in the San Francisco Mission to attend readings. It's a great event. And if there's other events for Litquake that you are contemplating of attending, you better RSVP now because the tickets are really going quick this year. Mm-hmm. Sarah, that was, as you were reading this, everybody, I was looking at in the engineering room and people's mouths were like, oh. And I want to ask you questions about it, but I can't because for the people attending, it's going to ruin it. But I have to ask you when the show's over because I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Oh no, I'm going to ask both of you. Oh no, both of you. I'm going to ask when the show's over. How did it feel to write that? We have a few minutes left, but how did it feel to write something so intimate and detailed and you kind of brought the Alanis Morissette vibe, but how did that feel so far? Because you're going to say this stuff in front of a larger audience.
Yeah. I think for me, the act of writing secrets and telling personal stories is really liberating. I mean, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, and I have great love for my family. But I also don't want to tell lies about the people in my life or my life, right? I want to be honest. It's liberating to air your secrets. And, you know, I keep plenty of secrets. There's a lot of stuff that's not ready for prime time. But I do find the act of writing and putting things in front of the public to be really liberating.
And especially when you're writing about family. Because these are people, I'm assuming, that you're going to run into.
Yeah, I'm really close with my family. I love them a lot, both my parents. But, you know, I'm not gonna lie about the truths of my life,
you know? Yeah. I know, what's that quote? Absolutely. Something like, if you wanted me to write things, nicer things
about
you.
Oh, the Anne Lamott.
Yeah.
If you wanted the writers in your family to say nicer things about you, you should have behaved better.
Right. Like it's like, ooh.
I tried to say that to my mom and she was not pleased.
I was going to say, you know, when you talk about family, I know that's a whole nother, and then the holidays are coming up.
Yeah.
It's like, I saw what you said about me on page 3. Yeah. I have a collection of poetry. So I called out people and they deserved it. And you know, that's okay. Everybody lived. They survived.
Yeah, that's right.
They may not like me as much, but that's okay. That's being a writer. I live and survive too. Sarah,
right.
Now I'm getting into my secret. Sarah, so how was it for you to express that?
Yeah, I think liberating is also a word that I would use. And I write about a lot of different subjects, but with this piece specifically, because it is about personal betrayal that a lot of people, I think, just hold a lot of shame around.
Mm-hmm.
For
yeah.
me, it was a way of dispelling that shame. And I've written about other, like, family before, which is a totally different sort of dynamic. But I really wanted to do something that made it clear that I was in charge of my own narrative,
mm-hmm.
that like, you know, I understand why people, I did feel shame, you know, when this happened, like I must have done something wrong or that people are going to judge me for like, how could this happen to me? You know,
right.
like your ego gets all tied up. But in the end, I think sharing a story like this is just a way of empowering myself and other people who've experienced the same thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you're being cheated on, like those issues can come up. So the good thing too, and I'm gonna wrap up, is that when people listen, they can find some empowering, you know, things, you know, and relate. I'm sure they can relate to some of the things you all be reading about and the other artists too. So yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
Well, I'm excited for you all. I hate that I'm gonna miss it, but I hope that Quake is recording it, because I definitely will.
They
listen.
Definitely
yeah.
are. They
yeah.
definitely are.
And when these mics are off, I'm gonna get the tea, y'all. thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Samantha Shea is the Bay Area producer of Generation Women. Her book is My Mother's Boyfriends. And Sarah Rose Cotterett is an award-winning writer and part of the group Generation Women. Check out Lit Crawl in the San Francisco Mission this Saturday. We'll have a link on our website with the Lit Crawl map and schedule. And next up, a documentary about a Berkeley artist's craft and her experience with cancer. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Wrestling the Angel is a short documentary that in a way inspires you to take more pauses in life. At least that's what it did for me after I watched it. It's about longtime Berkeley artist Anne Arnold. And in the film, she talks about the motivation behind her paintings and her own unique views on Aesop fables. And she takes what she has learned from art, literature, and life to get through her cancer treatments. And here to chat about Wrestling the Angel is Anne Arnold herself and the director, Jonathan Villette. Welcome both.
Oh, thanks so much, Janae.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you are here. It was just such a touching, touching film.
Oh, I'm glad.
And I want to start with you. You know, much of your work is still life art, which are paintings of inanimate objects like fruits and flowers. And you said so many things that really made me pause when I was watching the film. And 23 minutes, so much wisdom in 23 minutes. And I think with the chaos going on right now, we need something to pause, you know, something to listen to or watch to pause. But something you learned from your late husband, Ian Jackson, and he was an antique bookseller in the Bay Area. It was something you learned about art and literature, and I just really loved it. Let's hear that clip.
When I was first getting to know my husband, Ian, he was studying classical Greek at UC Santa Cruz. And he read me a poem that really stayed with me. When the shades of the underworld ask Adonis, who has died, what did he find to be most beautiful that he missed being in the underworld? And he replies, "Loveliest of what I've left behind are the light of the sun, the shining stars, the face of the moon, and ripe cucumbers, apples, and pears." And when he read that to me, I thought, well, that is what still life is recognizing the beauty of these everyday growing things that are around us and we take for granted.
So it was beautiful. You know, you talked about your husband and the things we take for granted in the busyness of life. and how your work reminds us to kind of pause. You opened up so much, Anne. What made you want to share your experience with art and literature and cancer in this film?
Well, I think often, especially still life, is regarded as a very sort of secondary art and a little trivial. People pass them by when they're in the museum. They sort of move on to the portraits or something else. And I was so happy to be able to share that Greek story because I felt as though it's it does. Well, someone asked me the other day to work with them on color. And so I said, why don't you go to Monterey Market in Berkeley and just see which aisle calls to you? You know, is it the apples or all the lettuces or, you know, which one do you find most appealing? And she came back and she said, yeah, I've been to there 1,000 times and I've never really looked at it. I've just been wanting to get something. And so that was part of what I wanted to share with people.
Yeah, it was really lovely. Jonathan, just to give some background to folks on you, you've produced media here in the U.S. and in the past overseas in Europe, Africa, and other developing countries while working for the UN. So you've been exposed to a lot of personal stories. Yeah. What was it about Anne's story that struck you and made you want to make a documentary about her?
Well, Janae, you know, making a film about Anne and that whole experience was really an uplifting experience for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. I'd known Anne for many years. We've been friends. But this was a chance to see and to show in the film her art practice, which is so different from the way I make media. I live pretty much in a digital world these days.
Yes.
Even my camera has a screen on it, you know, right. that shows me what I'm looking at. But Anne, with her hand and a pen or a pencil, draws that line on a textured piece of paper. Or she takes a plank of walnut wood and starts applying oil paints to it and builds it up layer upon layer to a degree of luminosity mm-hmm. that shows these everyday objects, like you said, like a bowl of fruit,
right.
in a way that emanates this beauty that is almost spiritual, even though it's something physical. So that was one of the reasons why it was a very uplifting experience just to be close to that process and many of the reflections that she has about it.
Yeah.
That was one reason.
Yeah, I can see why. And the title of the documentary, Wrestling the Angel, is a reference to the Bible story about Jacob fighting an angel. And he gets injured from the fight and ends up with a limp. But there's a part of the story in regards to a blessing and that you said people don't really talk about when this biblical story comes up. Can you talk about that and how that inspired you?
Yes, I had a friend had mentioned I was making tiles, and he said that his favorite Bible story was Jacob and the angel. And so I hadn't read it in many, many years. So I went back to reading it, and what I hadn't realized, I just had known. And usually in art history, what's depicted is the battle between the two of them. Rembrandt has a wonderful painting of it. But what they don't mention is that, and they do in the Bible, is that at the very end, Jacob will not let the angel go until he gives him a blessing. And so I that felt for me very much like what art is, that you are in this struggle as you're painting or working on tiles or whatever, illustrating a book. And then the blessing comes at the end as you're when it comes to completion and you have a certain satisfaction with it and then you've created something.
Yeah. So. And the blessing in the story was he asked for the blessing and then the angel hurt his leg and then he ended up having a limp. And
actually, you know, I learned later just recently that actually the injury happens during the battle, the fight. And then he gets a new name. He's given a new name by the angel. But I think for me that the injury is also part of the blessing, mm-hmm. in that it's like a visceral memory of that experience. And he has a limp for the rest of his life.
Right.
So it's, his hip is thrown out of joint. So it's, I think you are changed by these experiences, that it's transformative.
And what's really, what's cool about the documentary is that Anne's work is still life, but Jonathan, you got that art moving.
Yeah, yeah.
It's animated too.
Well, that's
so
true.
That was really neat.
Well, you know, Anne is such a great storyteller, and I think we got 3 or 4 of her stories into the film, and a couple of them were so great, we animated them, like you say, animated them using Anne's own illustrations, by
the way.
Yeah,
right, right.
These stories help talk about some of the deeper meanings in life that Anne sees, and I think we can all see, like, great story about the ants and the grasshopper,
yes,
for example.
Yes, I want to ask you about that.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah.
I'd never heard it before myself, and I don't know if I'm going to recount the whole thing here, but it shows a philosophy of life where the grasshopper whiles away the summer playing the violin,
right,
instead of laboriously just gathering wealth,
yeah,
basically.
See, and
yeah,
it's funny because I grew up hearing that story. My grandfather.
Oh, you knew it.
Yeah, my grandfather grew up in Texas. He was a farmer, migrated here to the Bay Area. And so I would hear that story often. And he talked.
As a negative thing, right?
I didn't take it as negative, but it was your interpretation, and it was interesting because it was taught to, like, you know, take care of business first before you play, right?
Right.
So you can, you know, because he was a farm, black farmer from Texas. Mm. So, you know, that was coming from
hard
a different,
work.
That
yeah,
was hard work and a different mentality, right? And
yeah,
so, you know, that's what the lesson he always taught us was, like, you know, get your work done first, save up for the, he always believed in saving a dime, saving a penny, save your money, save it for the future, because he's like, the grasshopper was playing and fooling around. Because I think in some versions of the story, the grasshopper was laughing at the ants. So I guess it just depends on you know, basically how the story affects you or the version you read. But I thought yours was interesting because yours is more of like a capitalistic interpretation.
Anti-capitalistic,
yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's a complicated thing. I mean, my husband sort of divided people between ants and grasshoppers, friends of ours. And I mean, ants really cling to that image of themselves. You know, they're hardworking. They make the most of things.
Right.
You know, they're very, and grasshoppers think that ants don't really know how to live. So that they are a little dismissive of that mentality.
Right.
I mean, both sides. I mean, we need both of them. You know, in order to survive. The grasshoppers I've known who haven't done very well are the ones who live too long because they have nothing at the end, you know, and society doesn't necessarily support grasshoppers. So it's, but he used to say, Jesus was a grasshopper and the Catholic Church is an ant institution.
Yeah, when he said that,
so,
I said, whoa,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, it's, ants don't think that grasshoppers make the most of their talents. And grasshoppers like to move on to try something new, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and also, too, it was about, you know, overworking, right? You know, and like you were saying in the film, the grasshoppers know how to enjoy life more. And the ants are just working.
Yeah.
And,
obsessively.
Yeah, obsessively. It depends on how, I had never heard the interpretation of the story. So it was very, that scene was very profound for me.
Oh, I'm so glad that it touched you.
And
I think, I don't know. I mean, I think farmers really, they do have to be ants to a large extent, but they can try new things and then they're being more like grasshoppers, you know, taking some risk and seeing how some new way of doing things might be better.
And too, you were out near tears because when the grasshopper needed food, the ants were like, no, you know, so,
yeah,
which is part of the story, you know,
yeah,
you were
right,
like, they didn't even help him. And so when you said that, I was like, I was like, that is true. They didn't help him. And then he died. So, not to bring people's spirits down, but
no, it's part of the story.
But it's part of the
story. Really significant part. And I think it's, and I think if we can all appreciate the other in each other, that then there would be, I mean, after all, it probably made the ants' work lighter having the violin be played all summer long,
that
you
too,
know,
right.
And they didn't recognize that. So, you know, that's, yeah. that's.
And that's a whole, and then yeah. that can also be a discussion of art, of like how we appreciate crafts
yeah.
more that are not art versus, you know, artists. We think artists yeah. are fooling around. Okay, yeah. we're going into the weeds. Let me stop. If you're just tuning in, I love that story. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with filmmaker Jonathan Villette and artist Ann Arnold. Their documentary short, Wrestling the Angel, is screening at the Hillside Club in Berkeley on November 6th. And you were diagnosed with cancer, and you say in the documentary that you see your cancer as something to, not to fight, but more of an unwanted house guest. That you like, you need to leave. How did that mentality, and I'm just thinking too of just the art, the literature, you know, how that all comes together. How did that mentality, though, of this illness is an unwanted guest, how did that help you get through your cancer treatment?
Well, I think one visualizes, when you have cancer, you have a sort of vision of what this thing inside you is. Yeah. And I've never identified with, you know, a battle idea of myself, you know, battling warrior kind of thing. That's just not who I am. And so then I started thinking, well, what does this mean to me as far as something inside me that I would like to have leave? And the house guests came to mind.
Yeah.
I've had ones who've stayed much too long. So that was, and also the idea of sort of sweeping
yeah.
something out, doing housework, you know, just kind of making things right in my own body. And so that was, but I just kind of consciously thought, how do I want to picture this
yeah.
as I'm working on it? Because I think there's a large psychological element. I mean, I went through all the standard Western things and have had wonderful Chinese medicine as well, but mm-hmm. but I also felt the frame of mind that I address this with is really important also yeah. you know,
and in a film towards the end you're cancer free. Is that still the
case?
So far yeah. so good, okay, because I know people
yeah.
might be interested.
You never know.
Concerned, but we're gonna put out good vibrations that
thank you
that remains
yeah.
Jonathan, what did you want to do cinematically to tell her story? Like, I felt like sometimes there was a nice soft lighting I'm no film buff or film pro, but I feel like there was a softness in the lighting.
Well,
talk about other elements.
Well,
too
that's true.
Well.
I mean, it was also with the help of my wife Fiona McDougall, who's the film producer.
Shout out to Fiona,
who's looking through the window at us right now.
She's an engineer, yes.
But really, what we were after was, you know, we call it a poetic documentary.
Yes.
You know, and poetry is full of similes and metaphors. And as much as possible, we were trying to imply metaphors
yeah.
in all of this, that there's a lot beneath the surface that could be brought out. And sort of I wouldn't say a truly spiritual, but there's a lot of spirit and luminosity there and reflection. And so that's what we were after, you know, like with the seashell in the mm-hmm. beginning. The film starts with a seashell that's being thrashed around under the ocean, and then it appears from the depths of the ocean up on Anne's desk, and she starts painting it.
Yes.
And so that was sort of kind of a metaphor, I think, or one way of looking at it, is that beneath the surface, there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of history, but there are some very beautiful things down there. And
yeah.
and it came up, and she focused on that. You focused on that and painted it from different angles. And at the end of the film, not a spoiler. Okay.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Okay. I won't give a spoiler.
We do want people to see the film.
We'll see the film. Okay.
But one of the lovely things painting, I had the shell painting that's in the film was one that I had started, and Jonathan said, "Well, we want to show you painting, you know." So I opened the container of turpentine that I use because
right.
it's oil paint, And all of a sudden, it was a little like, you know, you hear about war horses that then, you know, like when firecrackers go off, all of a sudden they're ready to charge. It felt like that for me because the smell of the turpentine, I had been working in doing tile work for a couple of years and barely any oil painting. But when I smelled the turpentine again, I was like, oh, I really want to get back to that. So after finishing the film and finishing that painting, I have made more oil paintings, which I hadn't really been working in that medium for a couple of years.
It's interesting how life or just little things will kind of trigger the direction you're supposed to go, you know, with your art. We have about maybe 30 seconds. Jonathan, what did you learn from Anne after making this documentary?
That you can extract some really practical wisdom out of experiences and turn what was a really negative thing for Anne into a really quite a positive thing. You know, like the Jacob wrestling angel, she took that experience, that very dreadful experience, and found some significance and meaning in it, appreciating life more, I would say.
Yeah.
You talked about you don't have a problem waiting in line anymore at the bread shop.
And I'm going to have to cut you off because we have to go, but I want Anne. Final thoughts from you, Anne. What did you learn about yourself after being in this film?
Yeah, the things that Jonathan asked me, you know, he trims himself out of the film, but everything that I was saying was presented as a response to something Jonathan inquired about. And so he had worked out some very good questions that made me really think about my experiences and my painting and just everything, you know. Especially, I loved going back to the poem about the ripe cucumbers and apples and pears, because I hadn't thought of that for many years, but because I'd been with my husband for 50 years. It was wonderful.
It's a really great film. Thank you both so much. Thank you to filmmaker Jonathan Vallette and artist Anne Arnold. Their documentary short, Wrestling the Angel, is screening at the Hillside Club in Berkeley on November 6th. And we'll have a link on our website for tickets. That's all the time we have at the Sights and Sound Show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, and board operator, Damien Miner. Again, join me for Creepy Tales with storytellers M.M. Olivas, James Cagney, Samiko Sauce, and Thaddeus Howes, and our own Hanad Baba, and a performance by the Fist of Improv. Books will be sold too by Medicine for Nightmares. That is tomorrow night, Thursday, October 23rd at KLW's downtown San Francisco spot. Doors open at 6. Show starts at 7. RSVP at klw.org/events. And we'll have another great show for you right here next week.